Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. It is April 4, and this is All Things Political for Monday, the 4th of April. We are broadcasting live today from Studio 4A at National Public Radio. And thank you. We have wonderful listeners with us. We have an audience. We have two marvelous guests. And, I come to this broadcast in a really different frame of mind than I usually approach all things political. I'm a news junkie, and I've read all the newspapers over the weekend, and I'm up on the news in the morning. But I think that for those of us who are in the audience, that we come to today's broadcast via Gettysburg. I have kind of this Gettysburg frame of mind. And the Kennedy gravesites, which I have never seen, that eternal flame, which really reduced me to tears, that I ran into some of you, I just couldn't stop crying. The World War II Memorial, the Lincoln Monument, the Vietnam War Memorial, Washington's beautiful Mount Vernon. We have traveled by coach, for those of you who don't know about this and you've been wondering where I am. I'm in Washington, D.C. We've traveled by coach with 50 WPR listeners to Washington, D.C., and each of the people in this studio has his or her own story, and I've been so touched by what many of you have brought, your good Midwestern sensibility and your knowledge, and we've been through all of this together, and it's been a very moving time. Today, we are broadcasting from here, and our audience from the bus is making up our audience in the NPR studio. We are going to also welcome your phone calls from Wisconsin. It seems so strange to be talking to Wisconsin today, but that's indeed who we're talking to, where it's opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers. Go get them. We have two marvelous guests with us in studio, and I'm so happy that they could join us. Ken Rudin has been a semi-regular on All Things Political. He's quite a comedian. I wish you could have listened to the few minutes before we went on the air here, because he's got a joke a minute, and he's got a quiz, and somebody's going to get a prize among those of you who are in our audience. And Clarence Page, who I've admired for years and years. He's a Chicago guy. I'm a Chicago girl, and they're just great. Let me tell you a little bit about them in case you don't know about them. Ken Rudin is NPR's political junkie, and for 20 years he has been the eyes and ears of political coverage as a political editor. He has, and I wore an honor because we were at Ford's Theater, and Lincoln is my guy. I got my Lincoln campaign button with a picture of Lincoln that I love, and I wore it in Ken's honor today. He has 70,000 items in his campaign button collection. 70,000. I should have asked you to bring some today. Yeah. He focuses on all aspects of politics. He's on, of course, lots of programs on Talk of the Nation. You can hear him every Wednesday in his Political Junkie segment. It's All Politics blog on NPR.org. And he informs us on the news whenever things happen politically, which is quite frequently. Ken, it's a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Clarence Page. Clarence began writing his column for the Chicago Tribune in 1984 as a local column. He went into syndication in 1987, and he's now syndicated in about 150 papers. In 1989, his column won the Pulitzer for commentary. He has been, as he said, in his own meandering way, a foreign correspondent in Africa in 1976, an assistant city editor upon his return, an investigative task force reporter in 1979. He became interested in television, but he realized that radio is better. He joined WBBM-TV, CBS owned station. He has written a book, Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity, which was published in 1996. And he is occasional panelist on NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He's on there. He's a regular contributor there, and he's also an occasional panelist on the McLaughlin Group. You know, there's so much in the city, and then today as I was coming in, I remembered that Martin Luther King was, I can cry. Every corner I want to cry in the city. This is the anniversary in 1968 of his assassination. So we come to this broadcast, and that's my first question for both of you, because I don't know why I didn't live in this city. I love this. I love this place. And there's something I would think about being a reporter, a journalist here, that when you've got it all here and all these people who lived here and who were good presidents or maybe bad, and they died, some of them, in horrendous fashions, and you've had these marches here, and it's all around you. It must inform the way you do your work. Does it? I mean, does it or doesn't it? Ken?
Well, it does, and yet it's not constricted to Washington. I mean, the last week I was visiting member stations, NPR member stations, and I was in Oklahoma City. And you talk about being moved at memorials here in Washington. I was at the memorial for the Oklahoma City bombing victims from the 1975 tragedy. And so wherever you go in this country, you're reminded by the history, and good and bad. But in Washington, it's all around you. You can't escape it.
Mm-hmm. Clarence?
It's true, and that's good, although... it's funny, the difference between visiting here and living here. I visited a lot in the 70s and 80s before I finally moved here in 91. As I used to say, I wanted to be closer to the scene of the crime. And I, at the time, I was, there was a president named Bush. We were at war in the Middle East. There was a person named Clinton running for president. And then in 08, I felt like I'd gone full circle. Maybe I should go back to Illinois. Back then it was a guy named Daley running things. There's always been a guy named Daley.
Yeah, there sure has been.
Working in Chicago. It's funny, though, because I found that living here, history was for the tourists. For the local people, it's like that's just stuff in the background. It's never been that way for me because I, like you, I walk around and I can't help but be reminded of all the history, especially when I'm with my son, who's tired of hearing about it, because that's the job of sons. He's grown up here. He's 20, almost 22 now. He was 2 when we moved here. Raising a child in Washington is different. This is a town where kids not only know what a continuing resolution is, but they care whether it passes or not. You know, I mean, I was raised in a steel town in southern Ohio, and we knew if there were layoffs going on because it meant whether our daddies would be working or whether we'd be moving or not. And the same thing in Washington. The kids follow the headlines because they hear about it in that regard. But the kids don't care about their parents. They care about each other. I mean, my son went to a school. He was a classmate with Karl Rove's son and
really?
One of George Bush's nephews. And it was like their parents didn't matter. That didn't translate. What mattered was whether you were cool or not. It's just like any other school kid. They don't care about what the parents do. And so it was – I mean, there's a lot of things you pick up when you're living here. I'm a political junkie. Ken beat me to having it trademarked and branding it. I love politics. So this town is like Disneyland for me, but it's also unreal because – that's why I'm glad to have some real Midwestern folks here.
Thank goodness.
I feel like a hostage being visited by the Red Cross or something. You know, yes, we're okay. We're holding out. Thank you. Can't wait to be back home again, though.
Well, as long as you've got these Midwestern folks here, let's talk a little bit about today. The president said that he's going to run for re-election. No surprise here. What is somewhat questionable is who the Republicans, how they're going to fashion whoever it is who's going to run against him. And there it seems to me as though there's a lot of news being made in places like Wisconsin right now that there is a refashioning of some Republican ideas that seem to have a national kind of strategy behind them. Maybe you know who's doing all of this. I'd like for you, both of you, to address the Wisconsin issue, how closely you're watching what's happening in our state and states like Michigan, and if it indicates a substantial change in the Republican Party.
Well, clearly, everybody knows that there are serious budget problems going on around the country, and it's not just in states with Republican governors. It's true in New York with Andrew Cuomo. It's true in California with Jerry Brown. So it's not, it should necessarily should not be an ideological or party-driven issue. But the question is whether these cuts are being made because the financial situation is so dire, or it's an ideological crusade. And that's what a lot of people are trying to decide, because in some states, like in Wisconsin, like in Ohio, like in perhaps in Michigan and Florida elsewhere, there are cuts that may seem draconian to some people because in the name of ideological correction or trying to have an opportunity to do to unions what Republicans have always talked about but never had the power. 2010, look, a lot of people were not satisfied with what was going on in this country economically and across around the world in 2010. And as Barack Obama has said in the past, elections have consequences. 2010 showed that elections have consequences. So with a lot of Republicans elected to governorship, increased numbers in the Republicans and state legislatures, they put their imprint, or are hoping to put their imprint, on a lot of issues that affect a lot of people, and they have the opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm. Clarence.
Yeah, people are in Washington are watching Wisconsin very closely because this is where the rubber meets the road with governance. It's governors and it's state legislators, and it's midterm elections where the really dedicated voters turn out. And in other words, usually older voters who, we have a much greater turnout rate. You know, two-thirds of us turn out to vote, while these young whippersnappers under 30, about a third of them, you can get them off the couch. With great effort to go out and do it, mostly in the presidential elections. So I am struck watching Wisconsin as well as Ohio, where I was born and raised, and Michigan, which I know well over the years, and Indiana, because those are the states where you're seeing these budget problems play out, where the real questions about how much can we afford with government and how much do we need, all that sort of thing, really plays out. And in terms of what we're now seeing, much to the delight of national Democrats, is a backlash against the Republican governors who are starting to slash services because, like that old saying goes, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that guy behind that tree. Hmm. You know, nobody wants to pay the taxes. Everybody wants the services. These debates in Washington don't really get at the real fiscal challenge, which is Medicare. And get the government out of my Medicare, right? This was a ironic slogan of the anti-government uprising with the Tea Party, et cetera. But the fact is that we're seeing this play out at the state level, where people are now saying, well, are teachers' unions all that bad? Are the teachers really thugs, as one of my conservative friends was saying the other day? At all, I think the voters, one thing we're finding, as Obama found after his election, American voters are true conservatives. And I don't mean ideological conservatives. I mean conservative in the sense that the founders were, of not wanting government to move that quickly or that radically in one direction or the other. And in my long life now, I have seen every time we've made a wide swing to the left, we make another wide swing to the right. And back and forth. That's kind of the strange kind of equilibrium American politics takes. And so now I'm starting to see a swing back toward the left. We're really always aiming for the center, and we always miss it. We always go too far, and then we come back, And that's what we're seeing in Wisconsin. So, yeah, people in Washington care about it.
Yeah. And who do you think the Republicans are looking at now? Who are they priming for the run against Obama? It's going to be hard for any Republican, I think. Maybe you have a different response.
Nominally we keep saying that so-called Mitt Romney is the front runner. Now, front runner is a word that the media should just destroy and obliterate and tear up because it's pointless. I mean, we said in 2008 that Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney were the front runners, and matter of fact, on the day of the New Hampshire primary, we were saying that Hillary Clinton was finished. A lot of media pundits would say she's finished, and she won New Hampshire. So if we can't predict the day of a primary, what's going to happen, to say who's the front runner, who's going to be the nominee a year and a half from now, is just ludicrous, and just in that we keep doing it over and over again. But it is interesting to see that in prior election cycles, at this time, for example, 4 years ago, there were at least 20 candidates running for president. Now we only have Tim Pawlenty and, as of today, President Obama. That's basically on. Tim Pawlenty only had an exploratory committee. But for the most part, the Romneys, the Haley Barbers, the Sarah Palins, the Michelle Bachmans, they're out there and they're making noises, but they're not. They haven't
done what they need to do yet. And I kind of think Republicans don't know how to deal with it because they did seem to have momentum at their backs. They seem to have issues on their side in 2010, and yet they know that Barack Obama and his billion-dollar reelection campaign is going to be very formidable, and they just have to wait and see what's a good time to come out. Because sometimes you can announce too early, and then you get caught being unprepared or filled with gaffes or misstatements, and that's the last thing Republicans want to do.
Let's switch to foreign policy for a moment. I think that one of the things that all of us have noticed going to Gettysburg, which I had a nightmare about Gettysburg. It was horrible. There I was. I was fighting on the battlefield, and all these limbs and everything were all around. It was because you get a lot of that when you tour this, World War One and Two and the Civil Rights Movement and all of the violence that we've experienced in this country. Let's talk a little bit about the president's Middle East policy and what's been happening, which I'm not totally up on this news in Afghanistan. I was in Gettysburg, so I don't know all of the details of what's been going on in Afghanistan. But there, we certainly have done shows even a year ago saying this could be the president's undoing, that there's not a clear policy here. There's not a clear policy in Libya, and what are we doing there, and what's going to develop? Can you enlighten us on what the president's policy is in both of those countries and what we're seeing today in Afghanistan? Clarence?
It's an a la carte policy. We've had quite an interesting foreign policy debate going on for a while. You know, why hasn't President Obama come up with an Obama doctrine like George Bush had? And, he has and he hasn't. He hasn't formally come out with a one-size-fits-all doctrine in the way that George W. Bush did in terms of promoting democracy, letting people know we will promote democracy in your country with a gunboat diplomacy if necessary. Obama has said we will promote democracy using as many diplomatic means as possible. But at the same time, you know, when with Iran, he was criticized for not moving more swiftly and forcefully to support the anti-government dissident movement there. With Libya, he's decided to move more forcefully, particularly at the urging of Samantha Powers, National Security Advisor for Human Rights, as well as Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, and as well as Ms. Rice, Susan Rice, the United Nations Ambassador, all of whom remember Kosovo and remember our sending in support there for human rights reasons, and that we didn't go in on Rwanda when Susan Rice was Deputy Ambassador for African Affairs. This is an interesting debate now. I got an email. A mass email from Tom Hayden. Those of you who remember
really?
The old SDS leader,
sure.
He's got a peace movement that is very critical of our going to war in Libya. As we say, and as we used to say in the Vietnam era, sarcastically, kill for peace. And Hayden is still there, and he says if Samantha Power. He likes her. He thinks that if she was of our generation, the Vietnam generation, that she would not be so forceful in pushing to go into Libya. I think she's right. I remember when Colin Powell was arguing with Madeleine Albright. Colin Powell, Vietnam era, Madeleine Albright, family of Holocaust victims and survivors, and she was arguing because Powell did not want to go into Europe unless we were going in with overwhelming force, et cetera. Albright said, well, you've got all these guns and bombs. What good are they if you don't use them? I mean, that's the kind of, you know, this is the debate going on. It's a very important debate. But I think it's important to be a la carte, too. Libya is not Egypt. Egypt is not Iran or Syria or Bahrain. They're all different countries. And nobody predicted this uprising, this popular uprising against tyranny, any more than anybody predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall. And if we can't predict the fall of the Berlin Wall with all these Harvard graduates in this town who are so dang on smart, you know, how are we going to predict what's going on in Bahrain?
Right.
Yeah, I don't blame Obama for having an a la carte policy. So I think we're going to see it unfold day by day.
I think Clarence is a little too generous toward the Obama foreign policy. And, of course, look, a lot of people were critical of the Bush foreign policy, which was derided as being cowboy stuck in his mind and nothing would change. He was very insistent. He had one way, and that was my way, and that would be the way to do it. But it seems that like we're reacting not only issue country by country, as Clarence suggests, but day by day and hour by hour. In other words, why is Gaddafi so evil in Libya, and yet why are the tyrants in Yemen or, you know, Bahrain acceptable? And then they switch parties and they give signals. What's the purpose of our Libya? Is it just for air cover? Is it to bomb the government? Is it for regime change? We don't seem to know that even the President Obama's address to the nation last week didn't seem to really spell out what he's doing. And so it's one thing. It's very interesting to see Republican members of Congress who would support these kind of incursions of the Republican president suddenly be opposed to it when it's a Democratic president. But even Democratic members of Congress saying, wait a second, we opposed Afghanistan. Afghanistan. We opposed Iraq. You, President Obama, probably won the Democratic nomination because you, unlike Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, John Edwards, or the other Democrats, were against the Iraqi incursion from the beginning. And yet here we are, more troops to Afghanistan, more involvement in Libya, because obviously our other incursions into Muslim countries were going so well, we might as well try this. So it's really, really unnerving a lot of people who in the past would have been opposed to these kind of incursions.
But if you're talking about fine change of bully, look at the Republican candidates and their positions. Like Newt Gingrich was in favor of our incursion until we incursed. And then he said, well, I wouldn't have gone in if I was president. And then when Obama essentially pulled out our involvement last week and turned it over to NATO, Haley Barbour was saying, well, that's not leadership. You know, so, you know, whichever way you go, you can rely on your political opponents to oppose it.
But, you know, but in fairness, though, that's absolutely true. But remember in 2006, the Democrats all walking around gas stations and pointing to the $4 a gallon gas prices. I mean, this is unheard of. How can we have this? These Democrats are not talking about that now. So it's obviously whoever's in power, you know, it's easy to carp at from the opposition.
You're right. I wonder how much of that is media, too. I mean, and the public. We seem to have gotten suddenly accustomed. I was putting gas in the car yesterday. I looked up at the I said, we're at $4 a gallon again.
Is it $4
here? I mean, really, they don't say that officially, but practically, your local gas station attendant's probably, you know, they're cranking it up there because it's $4 in my neighborhood. And I looked up and I said, gee, I thought we were going to have riots in the street with $4 a gallon, but everybody was just kind of cruising along Sunday driving. So
yeah. Let's welcome phone calls and also our audience, our live audience from all over Wisconsin joining us in Studio 4A at NPR, which is where we're broadcasting from NPR today. It's good. It's all good. So there's the microphone. I really urged you, and I will give you preference. So if the first person here will go to the studio audience, we already have people calling in. So it's yours first. Take your opportunity, your once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We have two fabulous guests with us, Ken Rudin, Clarence Page. Thank you. You guys are great. I'm happy to be with you. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is All Things Political, broadcasting today live from Studio 4A at the NPR studios in fabulous Washington, D.C. National Museum of American History, the Smithsonian. I spent a lot of time there yesterday. It's a wonderful museum. And also the chair of the Aeronautics Division for the National Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian. So should be a good second hour. We go to phone calls from Wisconsin and to our audience here. And Rich is I forgot. You're going to tell us where you're from. Hi, Rich.
Is there a case talk now?
Yeah. Yeah, go right ahead. Talk to him.
I'm Rich from Sullivan, Wisconsin, and I can tell you gentlemen that whether you know all eyes were on Wisconsin recently, they were back in February. Okay. I was out in Pleasanton, California visiting my sister for Super Bowl weekend. I just had to get that in there.
Who won that game?
Well, we have the DVDs and the Blu-ray for sale in the back of the book. Okay, in case you're confused about that.
We're not a Bears fan, don't you?
Okay. While I was in California, we had a meal, and my niece's husband, whose last name is Abdul Wajid, he's the first Abdul Wajid in our family. They have two kids, and we're really happy to have them be part of our family. He's been unemployed for over a year, and he said to me at the dinner table, Rich, you know, a guy can lose his focus during a year or more of unemployment. And I just sort of mumbled something at the time, but then I got home and I wrote a letter to him, and I said, I'm worried because you said you think you're losing your focus. And I said, you don't want that to happen. If you're not working, you should be volunteering. If you're not volunteering, you should be in school, either adding to a skill set or building a whole new skill set. Because from your focus comes some meaning, and from the meaning of that focus comes a purpose in life. So even though I have a young-sounding voice, I'm not a young man, and I'm looking back on my life and thinking about what I did, and I want to make sure that my family really feel strongly that they're living in an America that really matters in the world. We've been to Gettysburg. We even walked up to the site where Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. We took extra time in order to do that. You can't go to these monuments and sites without thinking about the purpose of America. So I'm not asking you to predict the future, but I'm asking you, as 2012 comes along, I don't want a lot of Terri Schiavo. I don't want a lot of runaway brides on the news. I want us to be saying, this is what America is about. This is our focus, and we can tell you what we mean, and we have a purpose. So whether you think we have that now, tell me what you want it to be or what you think it should be. I'd really appreciate that.
All right, Rich. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Rich.
Well said. Well said.
He's one of our regular callers, and I love him when he gets on the line. Oh, Rich is here. Let's go to Rich. Thank you, Rich. That was very well spoken.
I just want to say one thing about that. You know, I want to see Americans really read the Constitution. You know, as they're bragging about it, you know, and talk about it. We got to stand by the Constitution. And I love to get the – I get these emails and phone calls regularly every day or so of people saying, why you call us a democracy? We're a republic. And I've always got a ready-made response. What's the difference? You know, it's become one of these what do you call it, a shibboleth or whatever, you know, one of these things people say without really knowing what it means. You know, in fact, we're a democratic republic, if you really want to get down to it, you know. But it's become so that folks have certain, I call it ideological scripture that they recite. You know, we got to stand by the Constitution, or we've got to get government out of our Medicare, you know, stuff like this that doesn't really say anything. It's just, it's feel-good sloganeering. And, you know, read the Constitution. It's worth reading. At least read the first 10 right. Amendments, you know, the Bill of Rights. See what it really says. First Amendment, some people like the First Amendment, don't like the Second Amendment, or vice versa, you know. But at least read the darn thing and don't just recite it saying that we've got to stick by it, because that's why we have lawyers. They argue this sort of thing all the time. Now, what does it mean to stick by the Constitution? But it is a real document. What I really find after all my years of covering everything from Goldwater to Obama is that – I was in high school during Goldwater, by the way. So, you know, is that Americans are really about that far apart. I'm holding my fingers about a quarter of an inch apart for your radio listeners. You know, we do most of our fighting right there between those margins of the 49-51 turnout, and that's okay. You know, that's what keeps us stable in this country. But these are arguments over what is America about? What does America really mean? And I think we pass that on from generation to generation. It would have been unthinkable when I was a kid and we were still observing, you know white and colored signs over water fountains and restrooms, that we would have a black, or if you prefer, biracial president by the time
I know.
While I was alive. And now we do. And we're going to have a woman president. It's going to happen, you know. We're going to this is a country that changes, but usually always within those margins, though we still keep those values. The biggest growth we're seeing now is with Hispanic voters. We're seeing them in the on the Republican side is where you're seeing the next generation of Obamas, really. You know, Marco Rubio in Florida and other folks like that. And that's what I love about the durability of what the founders did lay down. You know, yeah, they did allow slavery to continue, but they also established the mechanism for ending slavery. And that's what's important about our Constitution.
See, I think we're more apart than that. I think there is an anger in this country that has been addressed, that is, we've saw it surface. Is it coincidentally that it was 6 months after Obama was elected? I don't know if that's part of it. But we did see at these Tea Party town hall meetings in 2009, there was genuine anger. Was a lot of it based on misinformation or just, you know, poor characterization of what was going on? Yes, but there was still an uncertainty, an uncomfortability about what's going to happen to my family, your family, my neighbor's family, my children, my grandchildren. So there was a very an unease going on in the country that has not been addressed. And when I think about how far apart we are, if you think of some of the Republicans in the past, like a Gerald Ford or something, or even perhaps even Ronald Reagan, those guys would be tarred and feathered in a lot of the upcoming primaries. There's a certain ideological rigidity that is going on both sides. You see it on Fox News. You see it on MSNBC as well. And there's a certain rigidity that is just not conducive towards a kind of a conversation.
Exactly. I agree.
You and I will never get along if we're shouting at each other. And these 24/7 cable shows promote the shouting. And so you see that anger and you wonder what's going to happen in 2012.
Yeah. Rich brings up this point. We got somebody at dinner last night. We were talking about Charlie Sheen just for a moment. And you think about...
You can't stay away from him, can you?
Well, we were just talking about why are people talking about him. All the junk there is
in
America.
He's now in the lead in New Hampshire. He's leading.
Along with Lady Gaga.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of stuff that people spend their time thinking about. It just seems ridiculous. I mean, why? Who the heck cares about any of it?
We all do. You know why? Because it's national conversation. It is something that, you're on an elevator with somebody. You don't know them very well. You're looking for small talk. You say, how about that Charlie Sheen? Because Yeah, because it's neutral. This is what Ken's talking about, the polarization right now in politics.
Because it's so polarized.
My daddy always said, son, if you want to make friends, don't ever argue religion or politics. If I followed his advice, I'd be out of business right now.
Yeah, you would.
It's all about religion and politics. And so people are looking for safe things to talk about, safe ways to connect. People are bowling alone, as Robert Putnam says, we're more isolated, we're more unitary, we're more mobile in society. So we're looking for things that are part of the common conversation. Guys talk sports, women talk Oprah, whatever, if you want to go down to this, using those common demographic stereotypes, but it's true, but we all know who these folks are. They're part of the common culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one thing about what Ken is saying. He's absolutely right. Right after the election, Obama's election, there was as much excitement suddenly on the right as there had been on the left before. I think that's subsided now. I can know what you think of it after the midterm election when far right folks saw, hey, I can elect somebody if I'm upset with the incumbents. That's how our system works. And so they tried their best to elect somebody as nutty on the right as they thought Obama was on the left. And they've done a marvelous job of it. The Democrats are just delighted to see the array of candidates who are running versus those who don't want to run right now. And who can blame them? Chris Christie ain't running. Jeb Bush ain't running. Not right now, and who is running? People who I call pundits delight. Newt Gingrich is the gift that keeps on giving for us columnists. He knows that. Go ahead, Kim.
But as somebody who follows politics as long as we have, I remember Democrats saying that about Ronald Reagan in 1979.
Oh, yeah.
Please, Ronald Reagan, run, because he'll be so easy to beat. He'll be so easy. It's exactly what the Democrats want. Mm-hmm. And I do remember in 1991 when the first President Bush was at the top of his game following the Persian Gulf War, there was, a Newsweek cover that suggested maybe the Democrats should nominate him also because they can't beat him in 1992, and of course he lost to Bill Clinton. So for all the talk about how the Republicans are so far out there and they're a pundit's dream with these crazy right-wing candidates, 2012 is a long, long time from now.
In other words, don't trust the pundits, because one thing we do know is that whoever wins, we're still going to have our job unless the internet takes it away.
Let's take one phone call and give the number two. Linda, just stay there. It's okay. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Mark is calling from Platteville, Wisconsin. Yeah, I'm sorry. Everybody will need earphones now.
Yeah, good morning. Can you hear me?
There you go. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi. I can barely hear you, but I'll try to make my point here. I want to bring us back
Mark,
to the connection between national politics
to Linda, and we'll
and
try to find out what happened to Mark. Linda, hi.
Hi, I'm Linda from Southwest Wisconsin. I'm from Platteville, so hi, Mark. I might know you. Paid my taxes, and I paid more than Exxon did. And so Exxon paid nothing. I paid quite a bit as a percentage of my taxes, up there around 28%. So I'm really fascinated by the Supreme Court decision that recognizes corporations as individuals, as opposed to me, a retired person on a fixed income, while I am working part-time because I want to, but I may need to soon. So I'm curious about the court decision that recognized corporations as individuals versus me as an individual, they now have a lot more money to influence politics. I'm curious as to how you find statistics on the 2010 election and the upcoming one on how much money is going to, I think, buy the elections.
Mm-hmm. Good question, Linda. Good question.
Would you want to go first?
Well, I mean, first of all, we're talking about a Barack Obama re-election bid that's going to be $1 billion, which is beyond the pale.
And there was only $700 million this last time, right?
And no Republicans have come close to that. But at the same time, we did say, of course, the Supreme Court, the Citizens United decision, did say that corporations and unions can spend whatever they want on behalf of a candidate. But it's obviously, in the old days of trying to regulate money, the Republicans will always say, conservatives will say, this is regulating free speech, and that's unconstitutional. But one thing we do know, that money will play a bigger influence in 2012. And if you think of 2008 and the Bush numbers and the Obama numbers, 2012 is going to everything else is going to pale by comparison.
Just Republicans, by the way, that said money is speech. The Supreme Court said it in a decision, a conservative Supreme Court. I think Justice Scalia wrote the opinion. But these constitutional amendments, ironically, and decisions, rather, go back to the anti-slavery amendments post-Civil War. What was interesting was, if you go back in your history of the courts at that time, the post-Civil War courts, they took the anti-slavery amendments and pretty well watered them down as far as former slaves were concerned, and thus we had Jim Crow segregation. But they strengthened them for corporations, and that's what the Supreme Court based their decision on, these decisions that one by one built up the notion that corporations are people. And how are you going to put a limit on campaign spending? I don't know. It's up to the public in a way, but not really. I think this is like the Indianapolis 500 track. It's just going to get faster. It never slows down.
Mm. Can you give us an idea? Because I think that a lot of us in the Midwest and in other parts of the country are kind of upset about this financial situation.
Which one?
Well, the situation, we got our own problems in Wisconsin with our financial situation.
Right.
But in terms of the people who lobby members of Congress, the people who help to write health care because they're in the insurance company, and so that they are meeting with members of Congress and essentially writing insurance bills for us, mm-hmm. the people who are getting bailed out, the people who are getting, I'm sorry, I hate to keep harping on this, but I do, because I think it's just morally wrong for people to be making billions of dollars when you got homeless people and you got people who don't have jobs or they don't have their future. And there's something fundamentally off with all of that. And I don't understand why politicians aren't dealing with that issue. And it seems as though something's gone terribly awry. Am I way off base with that?
Well, your frustration is not off base, but I don't think it should surprise you. I mean, if you think of it, there was a time, albeit a brief time, in 2009 when the Democrats had the White House and huge majorities in the House and Senate, and yet there was no – even with those numbers – it took them a long time to pass a health care bill by the narrowest margin, because now everything is you need 60 votes to pass anything, no longer 50 plus. Mm-hmm. And even if you can't have social change desired by income inequality with Democrats in power, then what can you accomplish?
Right.
Because not only did the House go Republican in 2010, but it's likely the Senate's going to go Republican in 2012. 23 out of the 33 seats that are up in 2012 are Democratic seats, so they have more to lose. So a lot of people think that the Republicans are going to take the Senate as well. And so what's going to get accomplished? And certainly what's going to address these issues of income inequality? I don't see that happening.
Yeah, the voters have to address them, and this is where it goes back to the voters. And what I was saying earlier, people don't like to pay taxes. They do like government services. We saw back in the 90s when the Newt Gingrich Congress confronted Bill Clinton, and we had two government shutdowns, the public swung against Gingrich and pro-Clinton. And Democrats remember this now. Republicans remember it. Republican leadership, though, right now also has the Tea Party faction, which does not feel like they owe their elections to the party establishment. They came in as the renegades, the rebels, whereas the Gingrich Congress felt much more loyal to Gingrich. But a lot of the ball is right now is in the Republican leadership's court, insofar as how far they want to go in trimming the size of government. And if the voters, uh, if, income inequality doesn't bother the voters, then they're not going to vote in favor of those who want to narrow that gap.
I think it is bothering the voters, though. And I think that what's happening in Wisconsin is very, very striking. I've lived there for 30-some years now. I have never seen anything like this. And I don't know if it'll last. I mean, maybe the audience has some thoughts about this. But it's hundreds of thousands of people marching and people who are very concerned about this issue, and it has to do with what's fair, fairness.
If you think of how the Vietnam War ended, it didn't end – the only way it ended is when hundreds of thousands of people were protesting down Fifth Avenue or in California, marching on the Pentagon. It forced out Lyndon Johnson, and it changed a lot of the political dynamic, whereas – in Iraq, how many people are marching against the war in Iraq or Afghanistan? I mean, the president calls for 35,000 more troops. Where are the demonstrations? Where are the marches? I think it would be very interesting to see in tomorrow's Supreme Court decision election in Wisconsin with David Prosser running for a re-election. That, if anything, we talk about referendums. That's something to watch about Scott Walker's trying to change the dynamic of state government. If he wins, I mean, look, this is – we like to simplify things in Washington, that this means – this is definitely what it means. Mm-hmm. But it certainly will send a signal. If Prosser wins, there may not be that much anger in Wisconsin as one might think. Right. And if he loses, that could be an anti-Walker tie.
Yeah, be very interesting. We're going to be in Wisconsin tomorrow, aren't we? Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's pause for a moment and we'll ask our studio audience to come to the microphone if you have questions for Clarence Page or Ken Rudin. We are broadcasting. As you know, we've been on a trip. We've been on a really good trip. We got to do more of these. This whole thing came about because last year we were in Springfield to celebrate Abe Lincoln's 200th birthday. I love Abraham Lincoln.
One of my favorite presidents.
Oh, he's top notch. Yeah, he's all right.
Okay,
he wasn't bad, was he? He wasn't.
It's okay
bad.
By me.
I know.
My family loved him.
Oh, man. So we were on the bus going back to Wisconsin. We said, well, where should we go next? And by a vote of the bus, it was Washington. And I just can't get over. Here we are. Now we're here in Washington, and we're doing this broadcast from Studio 4A at NPR, and it's very good. I wonder where we will go next. I wonder where we will go next. So we'll we'll give you the phone number again, too, which is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program as we broadcast live from Studio 4A at the NPR building in downtown Washington. We had a great afternoon. We went our own ways and went to various museums that are part of Smithsonian. We'll be speaking with the director of the National Museum of American History, and we will be speaking with the chair of the Aeronautics Division of the National Air and Space Museum. Okay.
Hi, my name's Lily. I'm from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, originally from Illinois. So I have a question. Pardon?
Wonderful. Welcome.
Half Bears, half Packer fan, so I have to do 50-50.
Yeah, life is hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I'm going to take a lot of ribbing this year. I have a question. How much influence does the Tea Party have on John Boehner? He always said nobody's going to persuade him. So how much power do they have in persuasion over him right now?
Well, I want to say John Boehner would not be Speaker of the House if it weren't for the Tea Party.
So basically owns them.
Well, no, but in fairness to John Boehner, he has a tightrope to walk that is very, very delicate because he is the establishment. He was elected, I guess, in 1986, so he's been around quite a while. And so he is an establishment Republican. And there are people who do, believe it or not, there are people in the Republican Party who do want things to get passed. They do want legislation to get passed, and they want to work with President Obama, whereas at the same time, the Tea Party folks who were elected mostly in 2010 don't owe their allegiance to anybody except the people who elected them. And so Boehner has to basically fight that battle. I mean, it's a tough battle. Nancy Pelosi had a similar thing with the Blue Dog Democrats and the liberals, but somehow it managed to accomplish it. But the Tea Party people are not people who look like they want to compromise. They said, look, we've been compromising for decades, and that's why we're in the mess we're in, and that's why we want to change the government. We want to change politics as usual. So Boehner, it's not so that he's been taken over by the Tea Party. He has a very tough line to walk, especially if he wants to keep the Republicans in the majority in 2012.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you very much for your call. That was Linda here. Linda's going to ask another question in the next hour. Lily, it was Lily. I want to to talk a little bit about the significance. I'm so steeped in history on this broadcast. In 1968, it was a rough decade. And you're reminded of it frequently when you're in Washington at the National Cemetery and the Vietnam War Memorial and now passing of World War II veterans and that beautiful memorial. It was on this day, which I remember very well, that Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And I'm just interested in your stories of where both of you, what your thoughts are. I know Clarence was alive on that day because we're exactly the same age.
Student newspaper office at Ohio University, and we had a teletype machine there. Remember those? That's how we got the news. We were the first people on campus to hear about it, and people came and clustered around our teletype machine. But I remember writing sitting down to write. A column, a commentary about King's assassination. Well, I'm still trying to process this in my head. And you talk about weeping. I felt tears well up in my eyes at that point. And but that's part of what it's like to be a pundit. I would learn later because on days like that or 9/11. When that big news breaks, that's when the public actually wants to hear an opinion they can bounce their own opinion off of, because we're all trying to process it and see what it all means. And that's where we were on that day. But I think the most powerful moment was listening to Bobby Kennedy speak in Indianapolis.
Wasn't that
just right off the cuff?
I know.
Got up there, and he broke the news to that crowd. They did not know the king had just been killed. It was a black crowd there in Indianapolis. And so much Chicago, so much of the rest of the country broke out in riots. So here in Washington, D.C., terrible riots broke out. But Indianapolis, Bobby Kennedy helped to keep
the peace. And he quoted Aeschylus, too, didn't he?
Yeah, for a white guy from England to get in front of a black crowd and quoting Aeschylus at that moment. But he pulled it off, and you can go on YouTube and see it. It's just an incredible thing to see.
That would be a good thing to do today, to go down on YouTube and look at that.
And remember, 4 days earlier, Lyndon Johnson made a dramatic announcement saying he wouldn't run for re-election, which shocked everybody. It was just true. Whenever I think of Dr. King's shooting and just the horror of it, and I was a senior in high school. I grew up in a small town called the Bronx. And I do very well remember Bobby Kennedy's speech. And, of course, Bobby Kennedy himself was shot 2 months later. So that two-month, three-month period was nothing like it in my life.
Yeah, same here. And what about the memorial? Somebody, one of our guys said it's opening this summer. Do you know what's it going to look like?
King Memorial, it is being built over overlooking the tidal basin, I guess. But right in that same vicinity with all the other memorials there near the Franklin Roosevelt and the Lincoln and the Jefferson and Dahl. And I believe I'm not sure if it's this year or if it's next year it's scheduled open. But
I think they said this year, didn't they?
Is it? Okay.
Did you hear that on that?
It's a massive project, and the photos and the models they've got look incredible. So,
And who remembers who the governor of Wisconsin was in 1968?
Uh-huh.
Is this the quiz?
No. Anybody in the audience?
Knowles.
Warren Knowles is correct.
Very good.
Who fashioned the collective bargaining for public employees? It was Warren Knowles, a Republican, who did that. It was not a Democrat. That's the darn thing about history, is that,
Can we say darn on the air?
But we should know these things. Why do we have to go thinking about all of this and learning our history about everything the day it happens?
That's what's so wonderful about being in this city, because you drive past the White House, you drive past my personal favorite is the Capitol, and you think of Bobby Kennedy was there, and John Kennedy was there, and Robert Taft was there, and Everett Dirksen was there, and all these giants and lesser people, but they were there in that same building. Henry Clay was there before he changed his name to Henry Ali. But it was just...
Ken.
I'm sorry. No, but it's remarkable. To me, that's very emotional. Because it's just history is right wherever you look. There's history in this city.
Also humbling for new senators when they report to the Senate and they're assigned a desk and open it up and there's graffiti from former senators of history.
Like Bob Caston's desk.
Yeah.
You know how that's touching?
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, he used to date my roommate.
Of course, I feel.
He did. They used to play cribbage.
I feel the same way about the National Press Club, though. You know, as much as press clubs have declined around the country to be hangouts for public relations people, this is a place where you walk in there and just the pictures of the newsmakers and the news journalists. You know,
I'm
the
sure
folks I grew up with. You know, I mean, when I came to this town, you know, cynical, sarcastic as I was, the day I met David Brinkley was just. it was, as my kid would say, awesome. Yeah.
No, I like you because you're not cynical. You know, you have important things to say. And yeah, you're not cynical. Neither is Ken. We have about 50 seconds, and I know you promised a quiz for the audience, and there might be a little prize. So if there's a winner, what's the question?
If we have time for this, the last person in Wisconsin to serve as governor and senator.
Does anybody know?
Gaylord Nelson is correct.
Linda!
All right.
Yay, Linda. Ken, what is her prize?
2 weeks in Philadelphia.
I'll take it.
An NPR pinned, convention pin from the 2004 convention.
So wonderful, Linda.
Wonderful.
That's
right
great.
My I like Ike pin.
And I always thought Bob Cassidy was going to be a Democrat because it kept saying DWI. So I thought a Democrat of Wisconsin. I didn't know what that.
It's time to end this.
Wait, is this on?
Before we get in big trouble. Thank you both so much. It was just wonderful to meet
you.
Both of you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank
you.
Audience too.
Thank you. Ken Rudin, political junkie, reporter for National Public Radio, and Clarence Page. Clarence is a wonderful thinker and has been writing for the Chicago Tribune with his column, and he's on, you know, McNeil Lair. Oh, it's not McNeil anymore. NewsHour on PBS.
Which one's Lair? You know?
Right. And writes his column for the Chicago Tribune, and you see him on television frequently, too. Thanks, everybody, for all of your... We're going to try to rectify our problem with our phones so that we can take phone calls, hour number two of the show. And we're going to now go to the Smithsonian, which will be great, right after the news.